Welcome to In My Backyard, an open conversation about children and mental health. We all know a child who's struggling, whether that child tells us or not. In this podcast, we speak with experts on the many factors of emotional distress in children, how to address those factors, and how to create a community where all children can be healthy and happy. This podcast is made possible through generous donations from supporters and listeners like you. Please visit tgclb.org or text HOPE to 562-262-5689 to make a one-time donation or join our Hope and Healing Club to become a monthly donor today. Your host is Tricia Costales, CEO of the Guidance Center, a nonprofit children's mental health agency in Long Beach, California.
I'm Tricia Costales, your host of In My Backyard. I'm a licensed clinical social worker and the chief executive officer of the Guidance Center, a nonprofit children's mental health agency serving 3,500 children and families every year. As we continue to explore the impact of trauma and stress on emotional well-being, today we'll be taking a closer look at mental health and LGBTQ children and youth. Any conversation about the mental health of lesbian, gay, and bisexual youth needs to be understood within a complicated historical perspective. It wasn't until 1973, and after considerable debate, that homosexuality was removed from the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders as a classified mental illness. Sadly, that decision by the American Psychiatric Association didn't end the debate. Even today, so-called conversion therapy is allowed in a plurality of states in the U.S., even though all expert bodies have denounced it as abusive and harmful, increasing suicidal risk in those subjected to it. Dr. Judd Marmer was president of the American Psychiatric Association when homosexuality was first declassified as a mental illness. He wrote, "In a society like ours, where homosexuals are uniformly treated with disparagement or contempt, to say nothing about outright hostility, it would be surprising indeed if substantial numbers of them did not suffer from an impaired self-image and some degree of unhappiness from their stigmatized status. It is manifestly unwarranted and inaccurate, however, to attribute this to intrinsic aspects of homosexuality itself." Scientific data does indeed demonstrate the vulnerability of our LGBTQ youth. As reported by the National Alliance on Mental Illness, LGBTQ youth are twice as likely to endorse persistent sadness and feelings of hopelessness. They are four times as likely to have attempted suicide, twice as likely to misuse alcohol and drugs, and have a greatly heightened risk of post-traumatic stress disorder. Also reported by the National Alliance on Mental Illness, the LGBTQ community is one of the most targeted communities by perpetrators of hate crimes in the country, facing labeling, stereotyping, denials of opportunity or access, and verbal, physical, and mental abuse. As many as 86% of these youth report being bullied and even assaulted at school. They are 120% more likely to experience homelessness and may be confronted by homeless shelters that do not accept them or where they are abused. Researchers Sanford, Friedman, Brooks, Meyer, and countless others have all found that this documented prejudice, discrimination, and outright abuse is the underlying cause of mental health disorders within the LGBTQ population, not their homosexuality itself. This is such an important distinction. Dr. Ilan Meyer wrote about this dynamic in terms of what he calls minority stress. We've talked quite a lot on this podcast about the way the social environment in which people live can have negative health and mental health consequences. Minority stress expands this concept to understand the excess stress to which individuals from stigmatized categories are exposed as a result of their social, often minority status. In very simple terms, if you live in a world where you are routinely seen as wrong or sinful or disgusting, where laws are enacted specifically to disenfranchise you because of your social status, It will have a damaging impact on your mental and emotional well-being. It makes sense, doesn't it? In today's podcast, we're going to speak with Dr. Tiffany Dawson. Tiffany is a licensed psychologist and the program manager of the Guidance Center's Compton Clinic. Tiffany and her staff serve children and families from the communities in and surrounding Compton, one of the most under-resourced and highest need areas in the county. Welcome, Tiffany. Thank you for joining us today. Listeners, just for you to know, Tiffany and I first met each other decades ago. Tiffany, I recall you were newly out of graduate school, and I was a clinical director at another organization. I remember you had your spiky hair and your studded belt, and it's with great pleasure that I've watched you develop and grow into such a leader in our profession over these years. For our audience who don't have the benefit of decades of knowing you, will you please share a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, sure. So, yes, you knew me when I was the young punk going to concerts every weekend. And now I'm the old lady who thinks the music is too loud, but the TV volume always has to be turned up, right? So, yes, I just first wanted to thank you for inviting me to speak with you today on this topic. I know the general goal of this podcast is about reducing stigma, and this population has plenty of that. So I just really appreciate you making this a relevant topic on In My Backyard. As far as myself, I've worked at the Guidance Center for 10 years. I've led the Compton Clinic for the past five. I've been licensed as a marriage and family therapist and a psychologist, and worked in various settings, juvenile hall, non-public schools, private practice. But the majority of my career has been dedicated to working in community mental health with children. That's really where my passion is at, is working with kids and teens who don't have an advocate. They need to express themselves. And honestly, when we don't feel heard or accepted, we act out. So I adore all the kiddos who are just raging, whether it's raging internally or externally. And because I feel like their rage is really just them trying to express themselves. And I think therapy is about being able to listen to them, maybe being one of the first adults to not respond to the behavior, but actually hear what they're trying to say. I get the privilege of doing this personally. I really do feel like it's a privilege. And I also feel like it's a privilege to be a part of the training of future clinicians in my role as the program manager. So I just really am grateful to be here today.
Thank you, Tiffany. I appreciate your comments about the raging child. Those were always my favorite clients as well. I think there's something quite adaptive about just shouting out what you need. So thank you for saying that. Back to our topic. I'm hesitant to say this directly because of the ugly history of mental health in this population. But in your experience, have you found it to be true that being LGBTQ is a risk factor for mental health struggles in children and youth? And if so, how do you explain this?
Yeah, so I think absolutely it's a risk factor. It's undeniable in the research that this population has much higher rates of depression, anxiety, suicide attempts, substance abuse. So there's no denying that. I think this is a classic case of whether it's causality or correlation. So in my personal and professional experience, being LGBTQ itself does not cause mental illness. However, the stress factors associated with that identification cause an enormous amount of stress that leads to these mental illness presentations. So under these stressors, it's understandable that there's a higher percentage of LGBTQ community that experience these mental illnesses. And it's the strain of living in a society that both explicitly and sometimes in less direct ways criticizes a core element of your identity that causes these symptoms, not the gender or sexual orientation itself.
So it's not the orientation or the gender identification, it's the way the world responds to that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very stressful experience, and in my experience, personal and professional, when the world responds in an accepting way, these kids don't develop these symptoms. But when the world responds in a less than accepting way, yeah, these issues come up.
What do you think about the notion of minority stress in our LGBTQ youth? How do these children experience being disenfranchised in their daily lives, and how does that impact them?
Yeah, so that's basically what we're talking about, right? This chronic everyday stress of being in the minority. So specifically for children, let's think about an LGBTQ child going to school. They have to choose whether they're going to use the boys or girls bathroom or the boys or girls locker room. And even if there is a gender neutral area, then they're segregated from their peers. They'll have to deal with dress codes or wear school uniforms or just clothing in general that is geared towards gender norms. They'll have to go to prom or school dances that have kings or queens or expect heterosexual coupling. And they'll have peers or school staff who will ask them if they have a boyfriend or girlfriend, meaning to just start conversation that will be hurtful or may misgender them without really understanding that. They'll join sports teams that are divided by genders, or even worse, they'll be told that they can't join a sports team because of their identity. So the list just goes on and on and on of all of the ways that just chronic stressful situations with these kids being exposed to everyday occurrences.
You know, that reminds me of an incident I had I was at the beach and went in to use the public bathrooms, and there was a woman in there who at first glance I thought was a man. Mm-hmm. And I was very taken aback because I felt unsafe and then immediately realized my error, but I offended her. And I didn't say anything. I wasn't going to say anything. I didn't. It must have just been the look on my face. I hurt her. And she said to her friend, she thought I was a man. And I was unsure how to, you know, I just wanted to go to the bathroom. I was unsure how to address that. And I hadn't meant to hurt her, but clearly I had. And that was coming from someone who tries to be very sensitive about gender words and all of those things. But I still managed through my just involuntary reaction to wound somebody. So I imagine where there's deliberate disenfranchisement, it's that much greater. So referring back then to Dr. Alon Meyer, he wrote about what I like to think of as what I think of as a trifecta of stressors harming this community. And first are the very real and discriminatory events they experience regularly, which then leads to the second one, and that's sort of an expectation of discrimination and the hypervigilance that goes along with that. And the third, then, is an internalization of harmful society viewpoints, a feeling that, wow, I must be disgusting. There's something wrong with me. I really am an aberration or an abomination or sinful somehow. And I'd like to, if we could, break those three things apart a little bit for our listeners. So first, discrimination. I've, really been thinking a lot about this. In addition to bullying and direct abuse, the LGBTQ community is one of the few minority groups where overt discrimination is still codified in public law. Laws around marriage and foster homes and adoption and sex acts and whether someone's allowed to refuse you service because of your lifestyle, for example. So let's pretend for a second that I'm a young child coming to the realization that I'm gay. How does this institutionalized discrimination impact my sense of self-worth and well-being? How does it make me think about myself?
Yeah, so I can say that I've tried to follow a lot of these laws and this very, very closely. I identify as a lesbian myself, so these laws directly impact my rights personally. I lived in San Francisco when marriage became legal there briefly, and the city was electric. It was filled with joy. I literally recall crying on the streets, walking people celebrating their recent marriage. And then to have that taken away with Prop 8 just a few years later in 2008, it honestly really shocked me. I think it was a reality check for me that in a state that's considered progressive, over 50% of my neighbors didn't want me to marry the person that I love. So that really was a reality check for me. You brought up a lot of the considerations that, you know, I can speak for myself, I make on a daily basis. My partner and I are considering fostering a child. We recently bought a home together. And in all of these situations, we have to take a lot of consideration into how to protect ourselves and our children and our, you know, assets and everything. Then there are laws about bathroom usage across the country. The most recent stat I could find was from 2020, but there's still 16 states that have sodomy laws. And sodomy laws criminalize sexual activities that are common in LGBTQ communities, but are considered deviant by heteronormative communities. So, and even laws that for mandated reporting of sexual activity unfairly target LGBTQ teens. There are activities that are really just normal sexual exploration for LGBTQ teens that are mandated to be reported in the same equivalent sexual exploitation in heteronormative teens is not reportable. So all of these laws are things that people just have to worry about. And then you brought up the self-identity. Yeah, I mean, all of these laws and all of these messages just repeatedly is that that there's something wrong. There's something wrong. There's something illegal. There's something deviant. And in an age when we should be telling children to explore their likes and dislikes, these kids are honestly constantly getting the message that what they're drawn to, what they prefer, is wrong, deviant, against the law, gross. So, yeah, this all gets internalized at some point. Am I wrong? Am I deviant? Am I disgusting?
Let's talk then about sort of one of the outcomes, the second piece of that I think very realistic expectation that you can be rejected for who you are, and that leads to hypervigilance and fear in interpersonal relationships. That is what keeps someone from telling their parents, their friends, their coworkers about themselves, what keeps someone in the closet, so to speak. I have to think that must be exhausting, hiding who you really are. Can you talk a little bit about what the psychological toll of this is?
Yeah, so this, you know, you mentioned your bathroom story earlier, and I can disclose that I've been on the receiving end of that many times, of walking into a bathroom and because of my presentation, having someone kind of be taken aback for a second. That's a common experience in the LGBTQ community. And sometimes, like you said, it's well-meaning. It's not even necessarily meant to be mean. But that creates this hypervigilance that every time I go into the bathroom, is that going to happen to me again? And that leads a lot of, it's a kind of a known thing in the LGBTQ community that a lot of people avoid public restrooms for exactly that purpose. So something as simple as going to the restroom can just create this hypervigilance and stress around, am I going to be able to do that in a way that's safe and that I'm not going to be discriminated against or be called out for my identity? So constant, chronic stressors around those sorts of situations.
It, you know, reminds me of a friend of mine who is a gay man, and we pre-COVID belonged to the same gym for many, many years. And he asked me to not let anyone at the gym know that he was gay, because he didn't feel safe in the locker room. He didn't feel comfortable. And to be honest, in my sort of privileged position, my first thought was that he's overreacting. Times have changed. Oh, buck up, buttercup, that mm-hmm. it's okay. But then I stopped to think about, I tried to put myself in his shoes, I guess, and understand, wow, what experiences has he had in his lifetime to date that makes him so fearful to have people in the locker room know that he's gay? And that seemed tragic to me.
Yeah, I think that's another great example that all it really takes is one negative experience. And it's just the way our brains work that we're designed to protect ourselves. So that one negative experience, especially if it was significant, makes us cautious of any situation that seems familiar. So you've had one bad experience in a locker room, you're careful every time you go into the locker room moving forward.
It's like a PTSD reaction.
It's exactly like a PTSD reaction.
And I do find that tragic. Let me, somewhat off topic, well, not off topic, but a slight change of direction, because now I'm ruminating about this. But my experience in the beach bathroom, my first reaction of fear was just, there's a man in the bathroom. Why is he in the bathroom? He must be here to hurt me. Mm-hmm. So that's a whole nother conversation about gender dynamics, too. But I certainly had no intention of telling her she couldn't be there or challenging her presence there. But I was so uncomfortable, I also didn't say anything. Mm-hmm. What should I have done from a trauma-informed perspective? How could I have eased that for her?
That's a great question, Tricia. And of course, you're putting me on the spot. I wish I had a really good answer. I'm not sure. I think that that sometimes it feels like apologizing and wanting to process it actually is just as uncomfortable, you know, putting some of the onus on now this person has to help you process your guilt, right?
Right. And that's not fair. Her job to make me feel better.
Right. But at the same time, I think you're also recognizing not saying anything leaves the impression that that you had a more malicious intent than you did.
Mm-hmm. That I didn't want her there.
Right. So I think that's a really tricky situation. I think that you know, in some way conveying that this, you know, I accept you being in this space, I'm sharing this space with you. I'm not sure what would have been the perfect thing to say in that moment, but I think that's really what it's about, is that this is a safe space, and mistakes happen and confusions happen, and but that, you know, there's not a rejection or you can't be here.
So a simple way to acknowledge what happened, say that I intend it to be a safe place and move on.
Yeah, I think so.
That I wish I had done that.
I wish a lot had done that as well.
Yes, I was uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Probably less so than she was, though. So the last element of that trifecta then is what I think is a truly tragic piece. It's that internalization of homophobia, the belief that there really is something wrong with you, then you're an insult to God, that what you feel and who you are is dirty or wrong or disgusting, and just how incredibly painful. Could you speak, please, to the toll that this takes?
Yeah, so I agree with you that this is definitely the most tragic aspect of this trifecta. And honestly, it can take a lifetime to reverse. I think, you know, again, speaking from my own experience, but also many of my friends, there are so many subtle ways that I catch myself in my old lady years of why do I have that impression, or why did I jump to that conclusion? So it's very subtle. It's done over time, and it's just internalized that there's some sort of weirdness, abomination, disgusting, that sort of thing. And then, unfortunately, there's also this self-fulfilling prophecy that reinforces this process. So this is something we talk a lot about in therapy, but this idea that through your actions, because you've internalized this belief, then through your actions, you actually, that belief gets reinforced. So let's say that there's a child that believes that they're weird because others have told them over and over again, you're weird. The way you dress is weird. You know, your preferences are weird. And so then when this child enters a social situation, they stay on the sidelines. They don't go straight to socialize. They're checking things out. They're seeing, is this a safe place for me? And the peers that are in that social situation see this awkward kid standing on the side of the room. And so they think this kid is weird. And they may say such. And the peers might not even have any idea that there's a history or what this person's sexual or gender orientation are. But they will respond to this weird behavior. And it just goes on and on and on and on. So I think that that's the really hard thing, is that it's really hard to reverse this process. Once someone starts to believe something about themselves, it's really hard to not have that be reinforced in their daily activities.
Because you continue to see those kinds of reactions.
Exactly. Through your behavior, you continue to see those kinds of reactions, even sometimes in situations where people do not intend that at all.
Mm-hmm. So here's where we get the increased levels of depression and the increased levels of suicidality, et cetera, mm-hmm. that internalized belief that you are dirty.
Yeah, internalized and happening over and over and over again, and just it gets drilled in pretty deep.
Given the discrimination and mental health vulnerabilities facing sexual minority groups, it is vital that we also understand the factors that ameliorate the stress this group is facing. Empirically, we know that the mental health industry doesn't do a consistently good job of supporting or understanding the LGBTQ community. Research from the Trevor Project tells us that of the LGBTQ youth who need and want mental health treatment, only 56% reach out to get it. These numbers are much worse within ethnic minority communities and regionally, with LGBTQ children of color and are living in the South most unlikely to ask for help. Apart from the usual barriers to treatment, such as access and affordability, fear that they will be outed to their parents, that the therapist would engage in conversion therapy, and the therapist simply wouldn't understand, were all named as reasons for treatment avoidance. Given the history of how mental health has addressed sexual minority groups, lobotomies were once the treatment of choice. This hesitancy is easily understood. Similarly, the legitimate fear of rejection prevents young people from turning to the usual support systems, parents and peers and teachers and perhaps clergy. It's time we learn how to do better. Now, Tiffany, I mean, there's certainly no question that mental health has failed our sexual minority youth over and over and over again in many big ways. Please talk to us about what we as providers can do to be a better resource.
Yeah, so that's a great question. I think, honestly, just acceptance. Acceptance at all terms and avoiding making assumptions. I think as clinicians, you know, we're supposed to be non-judgmental, but a large part of what we do, frankly, is making judgments about people. We diagnose them, we assess them, we give them a treatment plan on how to get better. So there's a lot of judgment that comes along just naturally within our role. And yeah, I mean, you mentioned this, but homosexual behaviors were classified as a mental illness up until recently. And frankly, currently in the DSM, gender dysphoria is still used as a label for gender nonconformity. So the psychological community has a history of, not really getting it right in terms of understanding the LGBTQ community. So a stance of acceptance is essential to try and correct that. Small things, take gender off your paperwork if you can do that. Add a box allowing people to identify outside of binary male or female. Don't assume pronouns or sexual orientation. Ask all of your clients how they identify, what name they prefer to go by, and try to use gender neutral pronouns until your client has declared both their identification and their potential romantic interest orientation. Avoid normative assumptions such as making sure that you provide swords and trucks and dolls and dresses to both boys and girls, and encouraging those children to explore whatever toys or topics they're drawn to without judgment. And I think the most important thing is never, never, never outing your client. So if your client shares their orientation with you, it is imperative that they are in control of when they share this information with other people. So sometimes well-meaning therapists might try and support, but actually they've just outed their client. So that's really, really, really important. It's literally about safety for those kids. And when the children do share the information with their parents, the therapist understanding that they have a vital role in supporting the family through this process too.
Do little things matter too, like the books I have in my bookshelf, or if I have a are there nonverbal ways I can make frightened or spatial ways I could make a frightened child feel safer in my office?
Yeah, I think having a breadth of toys available, having lots of different things, not having that child feel like they need to select one or the other. Books of differing variations. There's lots of good children books, My Two Mommies, those sorts of things. Just having an acceptance of lots of different family structures and lots of different ways of identity expression.
So as a mental health provider, I try very hard to be attuned to how I'm interacting with people. If I'm in a room, I assume there are people there with sexual trauma histories. I assume there are people there with mental health histories. I assume there are people in the room with a sexual orientation that's different than mine. And I try to conduct myself accordingly. I make mistakes. Mm-hmm. I use the wrong pronouns. That one really trips me up. Mm-hmm. What should I do when I make a mistake?
Yeah, so I think this is kind of similar to the question about the bathroom. It's not trying to need to process it with that person, because that puts a lot of responsibility on them. But just saying, oh, my bad, I made a mistake, acknowledging it and kind of moving on. I think that sends the message of I acknowledge that may have offended you, and I'd like to just move on with our relationship now, and because I accept you the way you are. It's hard though to do that, because I think there's some level of like, oh, I just messed up. What do I say? What do I do? And a lot of people freeze in that situation.
I guess by apologizing, you definitely take a stance of that I am a safe person and I'm going to make mistakes, but I see you mm-hmm. for who you are mm-hmm. and I'm okay with that. You know, that brings up parental rejection because that's very often not the message that these kids get from their parents. Yeah. And as mental health providers, it's our role, too, to help navigate those familial relationships. So what would you say to the parents of a child who has come out or who the parents suspect might be gay or lesbian? What would you say to them, and what can we do to help support them?
Yeah, so first I think we need to recognize that the thoughts and feelings created for parents when their kids come out to them are real and intense, and we shouldn't invalidate that experience for the parents as well. All parents have hopes and dreams for their child, and oftentimes their first initial reaction to finding out that their child is part of the LGBTQ community is that they feel like these hopes and dreams get shattered. I've often heard parents describe this literally as a mourning process. They have to mourn the child that they thought they were going to have. So therapists educating parents and supporting them through these grief stages, because the final stage is acceptance, and they will get there over time. But understanding that the parents need that support to get through that grief process. Helping the parents to process not only their griefs, but their real fears for their child. All parents want their child to have an easy path towards life and success. And, they have their fear that their child is going to be targeted based on this orientation is legitimate for all the reasons we've already been speaking about. But getting the parent to understand that with support, this child can not only attain their original hopes and dreams of the family, but actually develop a really great resilience that can lead them to even greater success. I think also just having parents understand that their child's happiness really does depend on them being able to embrace their identity. So the only path to happiness for these youth is love and acceptance while they're living in their true identity. If an individual is living outside of their identity, they're guaranteed to be unhappy. So getting parents to understand that that is the goal for happiness. And then I think another really important thing to consider is that, and acknowledge, is that the struggles for parents in this domain are oftentimes related to deep-rooted cultural or religious beliefs. So, you know, many cultures attribute being LGBTQ to great levels of shame, weakness, or sin. So we're talking about core values and beliefs for these parents that are being challenged, and we're asking them to step outside of those norms. And this comes up a lot in a lot of the communities that we work with at the Guidance Center, and those cultural aspects are huge to consider. So I think the last thing I just say about this is that it's just time. It just takes time, and it's not a smooth path. It oftentimes can take years, but usually parents end up at the point of loving their child. It just takes a really long time to get there sometimes, but with the right support, they can get there.
Well, and I'd like to, you know, bring up an example to highlight the importance of this, I guess. As I was considering going to grad school, I knew I would want to do community mental health, so I volunteered for a while at a shelter for runaway teens to see if that really was the population I wanted to work with. And I noted that a very high percentage of the kids in that shelter were LGBTQ. Mm-hmm. And they were either kicked out of their home or fearful for their lives because of their sexual orientation. And it just seemed so very sad to me. So the consequences of not facilitating those familiar relationships can be quite huge.
Yeah, absolutely. These kids are going to look for a family that accepts them and loves them. And if they're biological family is not doing that, they will find a different family. That's honestly, again, it's kind of a joke in the LGBTQ community about, you know, what is family? It doesn't always have a biological tone to it because you have to create your own family that's going to be loving and accepting. And oftentimes that's not biological. You create family within support groups or friends or peers or aunts or uncles, with quotations around aunts or uncles. And that becomes family.
Let's talk for a minute. I mean, we've been focused here really on the role of mental health providers. But I'd like to talk, you know, we're all human too. We're neighbors, we're teachers, we're friends, we're community members. We do live in a shared community. And I'd like to talk about how we can sort of in our daily lives support the LGBTQ population amongst us. And, you know, maybe I'll bring up one example from when my children were young. I have twin boys, as you know, and they were in, I think, first grade, so maybe 6 or 7. They were still in their booster seats in the back. And Boy Scouts had come to their elementary school to present at assembly to get young boys to sign up. And my sons were, of course, interested. It sounded really fun. So they asked me if they could join, and I told them they couldn't. That they couldn't because Boy Scouts had a policy that if you had two moms or two dads, you weren't welcome there. And we didn't support that policy, so I couldn't let them join. And they were confused. They're young. They were confused. They said, but we have a mom and a dad. And I said, yes, you do. But what about your friend Derek, who has two moms? Mm-hmm. Or your friend Brian, who has two moms? Mm-hmm. How do you think they might feel if you join this organization where they're not welcome? And they were really quiet in the back of the car for a little bit. I could like hear their little brains going. And then Lucas said, is it okay if I still like girls? And he was very earnest about it. And I still can see his little face in the mirror. And it's hard not to laugh. And I just said, yes, of course you can. That's the point. That people should be able to love who they love. So they didn't, and they understood it at that point. They never asked me again. We talk quite a lot about living your values. And that, you know, that's one example. But can you talk about what can we do to be more trauma-informed in our daily lives so these kids don't feel so isolated?
Yeah, so I think that's a great example. And I think that would be, that would actually be my suggestion, is how can you live in your values, whatever those values are. So your decision in that moment was that this organization does not coincide with our values. And so voting for legislation that is along your values. And hopefully the values are about increasing the rights for others, but just, you know, voting. If you don't know something, educating yourself. I think I will admit that, and we talked about this earlier, that I have a hard time keeping up with all the changing identifications and categories and terms. So just being open and honest and saying, okay, tell me a little bit more about that term or that identification. Encouraging that you accept all the diversity that's out there on this spectrum. Just avoiding judgment, having it come from a place of love and acceptance. Basically, we can never know what it's like to walk in someone else's shoes. So just being open-minded and listening instead of coming across as judging.
And live with kindness. You know, as I was reading for today, I read quite a lot about group identification. And you kind of touched on this a few minutes ago. But that helps tremendously in alleviating the stress facing sexual minorities, and that, you know, statistically, even kids who had parental rejection, if they lived their life sort of fully open and out of the closet and embraced the group identity, their outcomes were much better. So how important is it to a young person who's questioning their sexuality to see real and positive representation around them?
Yes, I think this is so, 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 so essential. So it's why community centers that are LGBTQ supportive or social groups and school settings are just really, really, really important. And that's one of the saddest parts of being LGBTQ to me in this country and certain towns that don't have that sort of support. So in Long Beach, where I live, there's an excellent LGBTQ center. And most high schools have some sort of LGBTQ affirming group or club or something like that. But in many areas of the country, this sort of group identification isn't available, and that's incredibly isolating. So unfortunately, this leads kids to try and find that group in a different way. They go to the internet. They go to the streets. And oftentimes this leads them actually to unsafe situations. This is why we have such a high rate of LGBTQ youth that are caught in child sexual exploitation, or you brought up homelessness. So they're looking for that sort of group. And unfortunately, sometimes they end up in unsafe situations in their desire to just find a group that accepts them. They're desperate to feel accepted. So even if the environment is extremely dangerous, they're going to go there because it's accepting. So having legitimate and safe places for that positive representation is an absolute game changer and can give these youth healthy role models and a safe place to get accurate information that they need.
You know, despite all these challenges, slow progress is being made. You know, the sad thing, of course, it feels sometimes like as we make progress, we also get the pushback. And so it's that constant push and pull. But what gives you hope?
First of all, I love that you end the podcast with a little bit of hope. I think that's just so important. I have so much hope for future generations. Yeah, like you brought up, with any social movement, sometimes it feels like it's moving at snail's pace, or we take two steps forward and one step back. But it does feel like things are moving in the right direction. Marriage is legally recognized. I'm hopeful that the tide of public opinion is moving towards acceptance. But most of all, I am so impressed with the confidence, determination, and strength of this younger generation of LGBTQ kids. the youth that I work with now, they're fearless and they're empowered to fight for their rights and their identities. And it's not just the LGBTQ youth that give me hope. The younger generation in general are just more accepting of diversity. They celebrate it in a way that I know I did not experience as a child. And I guess maybe that's why I have always and probably will always work with kids, is seeing that the younger generation and being part of their positive personal growth just gives me hope that over time our society can just keep growing and changing for the better.
Yeah, I couldn't possibly agree with you more. This current generation of kids, they take my breath away. They just feel so much braver and more outspoken and just embracing of change and difference. Then it's just spectacular to see.
It's inspirational.
It really is. I agree with you 100%. Thank you, Tiffany, so much. This was really fun. I always enjoy you and your unique insights, both as a psychologist and a loving, open, and out lesbian woman.
Thank you, Tricia.
Thank you. I hope that we all gained some insight through today's conversation. It is my position that by shining a light on these issues, admitting that they are in our own backyards, it'll be easier for someone struggling to get some help. Through conversation, we can become agents of change. Certainly, we can be a safe place. Please join me for episode 12 when we have a conversation with Dr. Robin Cooper of the Los Angeles Gay and Lesbian Center. Dr. Cooper specializes in providing mental health support to transgender young adults. I look forward to learning more from her expertise.
In My Backyard is brought to you by the Guidance Center, a children's mental health agency in Long Beach, California. In My Backyard is produced by Tricia Costales and Matthew Murray. Thank you to J. Vincent B. for original music. All other music licensed through Soundstripe. Thank you to our listeners and supporters. Please visit tgclb.org or text HOPE to 562-262-5689 to make a one-time donation or join our Hope and Healing Club to become a monthly donor today. Subscribe to In My Backyard on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.